Then he came.
And he said, hey, you Muzungus, you have the clock, but we Africans, we have the time.
No, well, listen, that example you've just given is absolutely classic.
Ibland har man tur, hörni. Jag och Leona ska möta upp Tony Blair på Postkodlotteriet och gissa vem som dyker upp i korridorerna på Waterfront Center.
Så, hur var han då?
Lite snäll.
Bye. Thank you.
Mr. Bill Clinton, eskorterad av ett tiotal Secret Service killar.
Hey, did you get a good picture of both of them? Come on,
to my sister.
Mr. Clinton hade bråttom, men självklart blev han charmad av Leona och frågade om vi inte skulle ta en bild tillsammans.
Thank you a lot, sir.
Den tackar man ju inte nej till.
Do I look as good as that?
Sen stack han vidare och gjorde sin grej och vi fortsatte till Tony Blair.
I'm not sure. I think that's a very kind picture. Did you do this?
You did do them?
Yeah.
Leona hade ritat ett fint porträtt till Tony som han krävde att få signerat.
Fantastic. Thank you. I'm going to take this. I have got a boy who is 14 years old. And I'm going to take this back when I see him on Wednesday and show him. And you've got the blue eyes.
Men som ni förstår så har inte snubbar som Blair överdrivet med tid, så jag tycker vi sätter igång intervjun direkt, där ni bland annat ska få höra mycket om hans banbrytande initiativ i Afrika. Men först vill jag säga tack till vår sponsor Postkodlotteriet, som har startat projektet som heter Hela Sverige för mångfald och tolerans, och som den här podden är glad över att vara en del av. Gå in på mångfaldframgång.se och se vad många bra saker folk gör, så kanske du blir inspirerad att göra någonting själv. Och kul att du vill följa med in i min värld.
Thank you. Tack.
Jag heter Leo Rassan.
Yeah, ask her to put her name on it.
Yes, definitely. So, nice to have you.
Yeah,
a wonderful speech, sir.
Thank you.
Honestly, I work as a professional speech myself, and I was blown away by your rhetorics. I was like, that guy, he's been to Oxford.
Well, I should have some practice at it. Where were you born in Sweden, were you?
Yes, I'm born in Sweden, born and raised there, but my father is from Bangladesh, so I'm mixed.
Okay.
I got one foot here and the other foot back from Bangladesh.
And you still get back to Bangladesh?
I try to. We run a small organization there called Banglabon, who works with energy and social sustainable development in a village there. So I have my roots back there. But in my daily life, I'm just a student. So I study my third year at the Stockholm School of Dramatic Arts. And this is a project that we're doing within that sector that's grown. So this is a podcast where we focus on diversity. Sorry for my English, sir. Excuse me for that. Diversity and tolerance.
Okay.
So first and foremost, we want to talk a bit about your things that you do in Africa, the initiative of African governments. Just a short version, what is it and how is it going?
The Africa Governance Initiative is an initiative that I... based on my experience in government, which is that the problem for a lot of African countries today is how to implement things, how to get things done effectively, and how to prioritize. So if you're a government, you know, you're not going to be able to do everything, but how do you do the key things that are necessary? Provide electricity, build the roads, have the ports, you know, get basic education, healthcare, attract in the right type of investment. So we have teams of people that live in the country, work alongside the president or prime minister of the country, and affect that change.
And they are good. They want them there.
Yeah, I mean, we can only work where the presidents want us. But actually, there's an enormous appetite in Africa today for that type of help, because today there's a new generation of leaders in Africa. They're not really interested in the past and arguing about the colonial history and so on. They're actually most interested in getting the job done.
Yeah. And could you give us some concrete example of how the process is you know, created?
Yeah. So we will help on very practical things. I mean, it could be how we deliver free healthcare in Sierra Leone for pregnant women and children under five, because they often die of some of the diseases that are out in that part of the world. How do you give them free healthcare and make sure that healthcare is effective? Or it could be putting up a power plant in a country, making sure that they then can connect electricity to more and more people. Or it could be, how do you bring in the right quality of foreign investment into a country? How do you help, for example, countries when they're maybe they've discovered oil or gas or big mineral deposits in their country? You know, they're negotiating with some of the biggest companies in the world, with a lot of lawyers and financiers and so on, helping the company. How do we get the right support alongside the government so that that negotiation's on equal terms? So it's practical.
Do you
things.
Share your experience on that to the countries?
Absolutely. So we share our experience, and we hire in people who have worked and done this in different parts of the world. And, you know, we form a nucleus of a team, typically five or six outsiders that we bring in, who work alongside the president's team or the prime minister's team.
Must be really diverse to have such cool teams. Could you, I mean, how is the team structured, or is it working?
Yeah, the teams, what is amazing is that we have vast numbers of people who want to volunteer. I mean, it's great fun as well as
yes.
being hard work, because you're right alongside the center of government, and, you know, you're able to affect change, and you're able to see very visible change take place as a result of your work. So, you know, we get very motivated people who come and work for us. And, you know, there's nothing more exciting, frankly, than working in some of the poorest countries in the world, but seeing the difference you make.
Yes. You said an interesting thing back at the speech about the difference between while you're running for office, you tend to talk a lot, but then when you get to office, you have to do stuff. Can you give me a take on that?
This is true, by the way, politics, whether you're in the United States of America, Europe or Africa or wherever. The hardest thing about government, I mean, government's the one job in which you put someone in to run something as complex and difficult as a country without any actual training for the job. You know, it's the one job in the world that you get, you know, it's by a democratic process, let's hope in most cases, but, and that's a great process, but it's not done on any qualification of capability. It's really, it's done on who the electorate like or not. And therefore what often happens, and, you know, I can talk about this from my own experience when I first became Prime Minister of Britain. You know, the hardest thing is what I call the shock of governing. You know, suddenly you move from making great speeches to trying to implement reforms in difficult systems. And that's where government today needs help. And the single thing that is most difficult about government today is focusing down on practical implementation. And that skill set, by the way, is very much usually found outside a government, in the private sector or in voluntary sector, where people deal day by day with implementation. Often what happens is politicians come into power, they've got absolutely no experience of implementation at all. So they've got to learn that fast.
And that's where you put your main focus on the implementation and the priorities.
Yes, and that's everything from, look, some of these countries, you know, the presidents don't even have someone who's properly in charge of their diary. Now, that may seem a sort of, you know, trivial thing to say, but it's, let me tell you, when you're running a country, it's really important. How do you use your time? Everyone wants to see you. Everyone wants to knock on your door. There's international conferences, local conferences, regional conferences, meetings that you've got to have, people you've got to see, stakeholders you've got to engage with. How do you get the time to focus on what's the right answer to my country's problems and how do I do it? You know, that's an issue. And it may seem a trivial thing to talk about, but when you're running a country, it's a vital thing. So, you know, we focus very much on those practical, they're all things that I learned the hard way in government.
I have a funny story about time. Now when you mention it, a friend of mine, his father sells trucks at Scania. So he was down in Tanzania and he was supposed to sell trucks. So he made an offer and they got the offer and they were supposed to set the deal. And they were supposed to meet at the hotel at 1 o'clock. So he was there at 1 o'clock. No one showed up.
Right.
He waited there, 1:30, no one showed up. 2:30, then he came. And my friend's father, Nils, he was like, come on, sir, how could you be like that? Look at the clock, it's 1 o'clock, you know, you're late. And he said, hey, you Muzungus, you have the clock, but we Africans, we have the time.
No, well, listen, no, but that example you've just given is absolutely classic. And by the way, he's lucky he turned up at 2:30 and not the next day at 2:30 in some places. But, you know, on the other hand, the new generation of African leaders know this has got to change.
And do you see it?
Yeah, I do see it. And I see increasingly with the new generation coming through an impatience with that attitude, because they know it doesn't work in the end, by the way. Look, turning up at the right time, again, it may seem trivial, but actually, in a world in which people can go here or they can go there, if you can at least offer them an efficient engagement, they're more likely to come with you than go elsewhere. So, you know, this is, look, it's this is not just an African problem. It's a problem of systems everywhere. And, you know, the Western systems have a different type of problem today. The Western systems have so much process, they become, you know, overly bureaucratic and often inefficient as a result of that. So, you know, each system has different problems, but getting that systemic focus and ability to take a policy, implement it, performance manage it, make sure that what happens on the ground reflects the idea in the cabinet room, you know, that is, you know, that's the business of government.
It is. I must say, you know, I read your memoirs deep inside.
Okay.
And you know, I recognize myself in the description that you said, that you will always be a rebel. Is it familiar? And I would say that the whole initiative in Africa feels like a bit rebellic to me. And what's your, because this is a podcast and we are all students making it, you know, your personal view on, on that mission, you know?
I think what's really important is to define what rebelliousness is in this context. What is it to be a rebel or a radical? It's not in fact to follow the wind. You know, sometimes people think that's, you know, sometimes people define what is rebellious and then you follow that and you say, well, I'm a rebel too because I'm following all these people who say this is what's rebellious. My view of being radical or rebellious is quite different. It's being prepared to look at a problem in a new way. So the reason I came to this issue of governance in Africa is because, you know, we did a lot on aid. You know, we were giving these countries a lot of aid. But I started to realize from my interaction with the leaders in those countries that, you know, aid was important. And don't misunderstand me, it is important. But actually, they needed something far more radical about the way they governed. And so I think what's important is that the nature of being rebellious is the preparedness to look at a conventional issue in an unconventional way.
Why is that so hard?
Because when you do that, people often reject it because it's not conventional. When you do that, people, you know, the conventional view is often a view that is expressed in a way that makes it hard to say, well, actually, I don't agree. And, you know, it's harder work. It's hard, far, look, the easiest thing in life is to follow the convention. It's far harder work to say, hang on, is that actually right? You know, when we go back to first principles and ask, what are we trying to achieve? Is that the right way to do it? That's a far tougher thing to do.
How can we create a society where that is more?
Well, I think you actually start with your education system. And this is something I learned over time. Because, you know, I regard life as a continual process of learning. I'm still learning today. Every day I'm learning something new. And I have changed my attitude to education over time. You know, I passed all my exams and I had a good enough academic record to get myself into Oxford University in the end, you know, which is kind of premier universities.
Definitely.
Okay. But I realized after a time that what I was good at was passing exams, but I was not good at creative thinking. And I had to teach myself that after I left all my conventional schooling. So I think today in education, it's important, you know, you got to know the basics, otherwise.
But you must have some creativity. I mean, you wanted to be a rock star.
I had some creativity, but you know, I looked at my creativity as something separate from my education, if you see what I mean. You know, in other words, in my education and my work, that was conventional. And then I looked at my other interests, whether they were music or art or culture, and then I might be a little unconventional. To take the unconventional into my day job, that was the process that was hardest.
Interesting way. So how now, if we just can get some comments, because it was an election yesterday, we can't block that, you know. And yeah. What's your comment on that? I mean, look, how come it's like this?
Well, I think it's not surprising in a way. I mean, I think Europe's got to really think about how it's governed, what it offers, how it puts forward an agenda for the future that connects with people. But we've also got to, we've got to stand up for a proper vision of the future, which recognizes, one, that the case for Europe today is stronger than it's ever been. I mean, there's no way a country like Sweden or a country like Britain is going to function effectively in the 21st century, going to be able to build support for our values, unless we're part of something as weighty and influential as the European Union. I mean, this is, you know, because the world in which we're going to live in the 21st century has got China, has got India in time to come. These are going to be countries with populations many times the whole of the European Union.
Yes.
Now, if we want to have weight and power, we've got to be part of that European collective. There's no doubt about that in my mind at all. However, there's no doubt also that we've got ourselves into a position in Europe where there is a disconnect at the moment between what people feel Europe should do and what people feel Europe does. And we've got to bridge that. And that's...
How do we do that, Tony?
We do that, in my view, first of all, by making sure that the institutions of Europe have a far clearer sense of practical achievement. I mean, I would like to see Europe focus on core specific things around making our economies more competitive, how you improve the quality of our education, how you get a common energy policy in Europe, how do you fight illegal immigration and organized crime, you know, how do you get a coherent foreign policy and defense policy in Europe, you know, these basic big blocks that people know have got to be done together. And then you're in a far stronger position to fight against this, you know, really narrow and reactionary view that is anti-immigrant, anti-Europe, but anti-Europe in a way that is not true national spirit or patriotism, but is a form of regressive and reactionary ideology. So, you know, I'm a great believer, as I've often said to people, countries like Britain or Sweden will do well in the future, partly because of the immigrants we brought in to our country. If we end up becoming anti-immigrant, it's just self-defeating stupidity. Now, you need rules around immigration. You know, you need order around it. That's clear. But to allow this type of anti-immigrant feeling to get a grip on a large part of the European population, that is disastrous for the future of Europe. And we've got to be prepared to have the courage and the leadership to stand up and against that. But it's easier to do that if we're offering a vision of Europe that appears to connect with people's real lives.
Thank you so much, Mr. Tony Blair. It's been a pleasure having you. And is it the biggest problem we have in Europe now?
The biggest problem, you mean this nationalist?
Whole, yeah.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem we have in Europe today is to prove the relevance and efficacy of Europe in relation to the needs of the people, for sure.
Well, thank you so much, guys, for having us. It's been a real pleasure. Sorry for taking that last question, but thank you again.
Huh? Yeah, good to see you.
I hope you get that picture from my sister, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She signed.
Yeah. Perfect.